bringing you fresh thinking about people, culture, well-being and leadership inspired by real stories. With your hosts, Natasha Wallace and Blair Palmer. It's the Human Revolutionaries Show.
Hello and welcome to the Human Revolutionaries Show. I am Blair Palmer.
Hello, Blair, and I'm Natasha Wallace.
Hello, Natasha. So, welcome back to the show. We skipped a week, and that's really to do with half term, Easter holidays, I should say, because we were working and we had our little ones. And it is very hard, isn't it? As everyone knows, because they've had their children at home, if they have children of their own, it is very hard to fit absolutely everything in.
Yeah, and I moved house.
Oh, and you moved house?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So
nothing to do with Easter.
I was trying desperately not to work, actually, because my daughter, my 10-year-old daughter, really doesn't like it when I'm off on holiday. And then I start trying to work. She doesn't understand that at all. And of course, you know, it's a fair point, isn't it? Mum, you're supposed to be on holiday. Why are you having a meeting? It's just a short one. Well, but you're on holiday. And of course, I work in wellbeing. So it's just, you know, it doesn't stack up for her. It doesn't stack up for me. So yeah, we had a week off, which was nice.
Yeah, yeah. But you had an interesting, we were talking about this before we record, you had an interesting experience with trying to get income protection, which we might just dive into for a sec.
Yeah, so I've never applied for income protection before. And actually, I've been self-employed now for nearly 4 years and just thought, oh, I should probably get income protection. You know, when I was in employment, I had an amazing income protection policy, which gave you 75% cover for your income for life. But anyway, so I applied for income protection. It was a blooming arduous process. I mean, oh my goodness. I had to apply for two separate policies, which seemed bonkers, to get the cover that I needed. So did that. And the insurer contacted me a couple of days ago to give me the sort of outcome of the application. And it had all gone through, apart from the fact that I won't be covered for any mental health challenges, issues at all. And the reason is because, I mean, I had to be honest when I was filling out the application. I mean, apart from the fact that obviously it's good to be honest, they will pull your medical records anyway. So, I mean, anything that has gone on in my life, they'll see. And they asked me if I'd ever suffered with mental ill health. And I said that I had postnatal depression after my first child. So that was nearly 11 years ago, 11 years ago. And I've had a couple of bouts of anxiety where I've just felt very, very stressed due to personal issues or overwork or whatever was going on at the time. To be honest, I couldn't really remember what had led to the stress or when it happened. I just knew that I had been to the doctors a couple of times saying, I feel a bit weird. I feel wired. I don't know what's wrong with me. And on both occasions, they said, you're stressed. So I declared that. And because of that, and this is in my whole adult life, yeah? So I'm 42. And because of that, they weren't covering me for mental health issues, any time off work for mental health. And I was really astounded by that. Now, you know, if there's insurers listening to this, they'll probably say, well, hold on, it wouldn't stack up for us to cover mental health if you have, you know, previous, because actually, you know, your insurance premium would go through the roof and it wouldn't work. But I thought there's all this work happening at the moment to destigmatize mental ill health. And we're saying, speak about it, you know, be honest about it. Everybody come out and tell, you know, say that you're stressed. Go to your doctor if you're stressed. Get counselling, get therapy, whatever it is. But actually, this is probably one very, very good reason why you wouldn't be honest about it. Because actually, you know, if I'd been self-employed my whole life and I knew that this was something that would impact my ability to get full cover as part of my income protection, I probably wouldn't go to the doctors about it, if I'm honest. And actually, at one point, I went to my medical insurers to get some therapy. And I thought, oh, that's fine. I probably don't have to declare that, because that was through my another insurers. And, you know, it wasn't through my doctor. So I wasn't making claims on the state or anything. And they said, oh, no, it doesn't make any difference. They would have sent all that information through to your doctors anyway. So I think it's bad. I don't know how to fix that problem, because I'm sure that, you know, it's a premium problem to some extent, but it's not good, is it? It's not good.
No, I mean, it is the way that insurance works. They just, it's an algorithm, you know, you are betting that you will get sick, and they're betting that you won't.
Mm.
And so if they can't make that bet, if they think you might, because then they're going to lose money. That's going to cost them something. Yeah. So, you know, and of course there are ways. I just got some medical health insurance, which actually does cover mental health stuff, because I haven't had any previous, but it's what they call a continuing insurance. So it just takes over from my previous insurance, which means that if I had a pre-existing condition, it's fine. This isn't a brand new policy. So the way around it is you start young and you just keep that insurance going so that as you get sick, it's not a pre-existing condition that you had from before the insurance.
Yeah.
But I mean, of course, you can't always anticipate that. And you wouldn't have needed this insurance when you were in employment. So it is controversial. I do think that it puts a barrier up around people not only talking about it, but seeking professional help, because then it's on a record.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, not only does it have insurance implications or whatever, but perception implications are then in writing.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, if I think about the two insurers who I've been insured for my medical insurance, so Bupa and Helix, who are sort of a white label insurance product that companies bring in, they covered pre-existing conditions. So I guess my previous experience of these very, very good insurers who took a belt and braces approach and just allowed you to claim for anything was that mental health would be covered. But of course, I mean, I'm sure my employer was, I mean, if I think back to like my P11D taxable benefit value, I mean, my private medical insurance was probably about £400 a year. I mean, bearing in mind, I only know this because I work in HR, not because I'm really sad and know what P11D amounts should be, but it's probably about £400 a year, and I'm going to be paying a lot more than that for my income protection. So there's a glitch in the system there, and I actually thought I need to reach out to the industry somehow. So that's on my to-do list, because I just don't think I don't know if I can make any difference, but I just don't think it's right. I don't think on the one hand we can be telling people to declare their mental ill health, and on the other hand penalising them for doing it.
Well, I mean, if anyone's listening and this is the bugbear of theirs, or they have some connections, then maybe they can reach out to you and you can put a little group together to have a look at this. Because of course, as an employer, you have the purchasing power to get quite good deals, and across the board of all your people, chances are very few make claims. So, you know, that is maybe why a company can get really, really good deals that cover pre-existing conditions, whatever. Yeah. But yeah, with when you're an individual, you're just not going to be able to get that sort of deal. And maybe it makes it really difficult, particularly as we enter a time, it's one of the things we'll talk about in a minute, where more and more people are thinking of leaving the security of a full-time PAYE type job and going it alone in some way, either as a freelancer or working more flexibly or interim or whatever it might be, or start their own business, of course. If that is the way that our economy is going, then that is going to have across the board implications for things like insurance.
Yeah, it will. It absolutely will. Well, with that in mind, shall we go to our work in the news?
Work in the news.
So the story that we are talking about this week is to do with the job title, stay at home mum. Do they have a stay at home dad? But anyway, we know they have it. They do. Okay. The job title, stay at home mum or stay at home parent, being an option on LinkedIn. So up until now, and people will know this already if they use LinkedIn and if they've created a profile for themselves, that you put basically inputting your CV. And so you're selecting job titles to put in as your CV. And up until recently, that wasn't on there, which then means that there can be unexplained gaps in your CV. So having this opportunity to put stay at home mom, stay at home dad, stay at home parent, whatever, is seen as a big step forward. And as far as I can see, universal excitement and acknowledgement that this is a good thing. So I'll come to how I feel about it. I absolutely think that having that, being able to explain a gap in your CV because you were full-time parenting is great. And, you know, without that option, then there's just this unexplained gap, which could be for anything. And now it can be explained. So from that perspective, I think it's very good. Before I launch into some issues I have, maybe we can hear from you, Natasha, what you make of it.
I mean, to be honest, I think they had something like homemaker on it before, which, I mean, just sounds awful. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think in terms of the actual label, you know, stay at home parent, stay at home mum, stay at home dad, no real issue. What I do take issue with is the fact that time out of the workplace could potentially make somebody any less able to do a job than they would otherwise have been. Now, there is a sort of momentum thing. I was thinking about this, you know, what is the difference between being a capable, able, you know, reasonably intelligent person in the workplace without a break in employment and being that same person with a break in employment? And it's probably just momentum, i.e. you take a bit of time out, you're out of practice, you know, bit rough, rusty around the edges. And so your sort of time to mobilize might take a little bit longer. Your confidence may be a little bit knocked. And I know plenty of mothers in particular, because that's my sort of, you know, peer group, friendship group. I know plenty of mothers who've taken time out of the workplace, not just, you know, long term, but actually just for regular maternity leave, and have felt very nervous and anxious about going back to work, because any time out of work makes you feel as though you've sort of lost touch, lost contact. You're not in touch with what's going on in the workplace. So I think there's a momentum thing. And I think employers, when bringing people who have had time out of the workplace back into work, need to accommodate for that. I think they need to recognise the fact that there'll be a bit of a ramp up period, but actually it's worth investing in the ramp up period, because when you've gotten through that, you've got this capable, able person who's able to do a good job, right? So I think that is something that we need to be aware of. But I also think that I think it's quite unfair for employers to expect people to stay in the workplace all of the time. And I think the world is evolving to the point where, you know, maybe in 10, 15 years, that won't be the expectation. We're recognizing that our needs matter too. People are, you know, making smart decisions about money that's giving them the opportunity to take time out of the workplace. People are looking for more meaning and purpose in their work. They don't necessarily want to work full-time hours. There does seem to be a bit of a shift towards people actually taking control of the way that they work. And I think employers probably need to recognise that. So I think that if you have a bias in your organisation that automatically deselects people who have taken a sort of significant chunk of time out of the workplace, then I think you probably do need to reconsider your recruitment.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that touches on a couple of things that I wanted to mention. The first is that it may do something to change perceptions that it's now an official job title, I suppose. But it isn't enough on its own. It explains a gap, but there's still plenty of people who are very, very judgmental about somebody choosing to take a career break in order to do something else, particularly if that something else is raise their child or their children. I think that those people who have done that are still going to face quite a lot of judgment when they start reapplying for jobs, or when even further down the line, they've been back in the workforce for, 10, 15 years, but there's still this, you took 10 years off to raise your children. I still think that there is going to be that judgment around it. It's now just officially on your CV for all to see, as opposed to it was just a bit of a gap and people would interpret it the way that they wanted to until they asked you about it. So I don't think it does everything it's supposed to do. I think we absolutely need to change perceptions of exactly what you've been saying, which is people don't have to do this 30, 35 years, 40 years without a break. There might be lots of reasons why people want to take, that we went traveling for 7 months and I didn't really take a break because I was working my way around. But I mean, it was a very different period of time for me. And if I had had a full-time job, I would have had to leave it to do that. Sometimes people, they just go off to find themselves. Sometimes people have a slightly hit and miss experience of thinking that they'd like to, be a full-time singer or an artist or, start their own business of some kind. It doesn't work out. So then they re-enter the workforce. There are lots of reasons why people take these gaps and why they should be allowed to take those gaps. And that those gaps can often be hugely beneficial to whoever then comes to employ them later. One of the things that I see is that, employers or companies are often looking for industry experience. I'm applying for lots of non-exec roles at the moment. Well, I'm not applying for that many because a lot of them say needs industry experience. Well, the assumption is that if I don't have that industry experience, I can't add value. And in some cases it's absolutely true because the NED role is something very, very specific that needs that. But sometimes what I'm noticing in terms of the things I'm applying for and other jobs that they're advertising is the same people just bouncing around all the different companies within that industry. It's very, very inward facing. And the same thing with having judgment about people taking breaks from that career trajectory, that there's this somehow assumption that they didn't, that nothing they gained while they were off doing the other thing is a benefit to us. Whereas actually, of course, it can be of huge benefit. Even just the time to appreciate how much you love working might be the thing that you bring back. So I think we really, companies, employers, those of us that work with people who have taken those sorts of breaks, need to learn how to appreciate what those people are bringing that maybe they couldn't have brought if they hadn't taken that break. And that's a bigger job.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? It's almost like that there can often be a sort of maturation process that happens when you're out of the workplace. Because when you're in the workplace, you're in the pursuit of delivery. I mean, most of us, most of the time, are just trying to get ink done, aren't we? We're trying to get deliverables delivered on, things executed, etc. And actually, often when you do take that time away, as we would have done when we had kids, other people have done on sabbaticals, people might even do it for mental ill health, any sort of ill health, it gives you time for reflection and perspective and personal growth. And actually, I think that can bring a huge amount. And I must admit, often, or a lot of the working mums in particular that I have worked with over the years, I've loved their maternal instinct in the office. I've loved the mum bit that they've brought, that bit where they take care of people, where they check in on people. And I think you can't underestimate the power of that. Often you know, these people are the glue that actually binds the whole team together, because they're watching, they're listening, they're aware, they've got that space, or they've got that perspective, or they've had that learning, or whatever, you know. And I think that that can add heaps to a team environment. Because it isn't just about delivery, it isn't just about getting things done, it is about that conscious awareness of what's actually going on in the team too. And I don't want to stereotype, I'm not saying, you know, all mothers go in and they then are the mothers in work. I mean, that's not a useful frame of reference, but I have enjoyed people in the office who have played that role. I think it's made a real difference.
Can I touch on the thing that might be hard for me to express and might come across negative?
Okay.
Which is that a lot of the stay-at-home mums that I have seen talking about this have pointed out that they weren't just stay-at-home mums. They were also managing the family's finances. They were also raising money for charity. Someone I know raised more than £1 million for charity while she was also raising her children. The example in the article that I was reading about this, she managed 2 international moves for her family during that period of time. That's the bit that I think is a little uncomfortable for me, because that's not stay-at-home mum. That is something as well as stay-at-home mum. And what those mums seem to have done is to say, don't worry, I wasn't just raising my children. I was also doing some more impressive stuff, by the way, that, you know, that you should probably take account of. Now, it is true that they were, but that isn't encompassed in the title stay-at-home mum. So even they are undermining the value of just raising children. And there's another bit of it that's a little uncomfortable for me, which is, yes, but I have a child. I also have a job. And I also managed to move house, and I also managed the family finances. So it's not, this is where I just can't express it very clearly, but I'm not that impressed that you managed to be a stay-at-home mum and do those things when I managed to be a working mum and do those things.
Okay, that is really interesting. And yes, probably there will now be some offended people listening to this podcast thinking, you don't know what you're talking about, Blair Palmer. So, you know, write in, please, with your comments on that. Interesting, I looked at it differently, you know. But I think that's valid. I think that if a mum who has been taking care of and bringing up her children feels as though she's having to justify herself, that's one thing. But I actually maybe look at it from a different, so I worked in recruitment, this is where I started. So I would work with people who are re-entering the workforce, and we would spend quite a lot of time looking at their transferable skills. And that was something that was a really important part of the conversation that I would have with people. Because actually it was also part of building their confidence. There's a lot of people who re-enter the workforce who don't feel as if they have as much to offer as they actually have, you know? So you sit down and you say, right, what are the transferable skills? What are the skills that you've been using in your day-to-day life that you can now bring into the workplace? Because it should be so much more sophisticated than looking at, you know, this person's job title and set of responsibilities and this job over here and then doing some sort of match. I mean, I think we've probably, you know, got a little bit more intelligence that we can do something a little bit more sophisticated than that. So if you as a person say, right, well, I've done all of this stuff and it doesn't really matter whether it was because I was a mum or because I was working in a charity or because I was, you know, leading some sort of guiding group or brownie group or whatever it was, what were the skills I used to do a good job there? And then we tease those out and then we present those to the employer, because isn't that really what we should be doing anyway?
That's right. And maybe my discomfort actually is around the job titles thing. The job title is supposed to tell someone what you're suitable for. And I wonder if actually what we need to do is to move away from job titles more to skills, qualities, passions, interests,
values,
all of those kind of things that can't be summarized in a, from 1998 until 2003, I was the chief blah, blah of something. And then from 2003 to 2007, nothing. And then from 2007 and until 2004, you know, it's not helpful. I think that I wonder if maybe this is me just trying to appeal to people to like me again. But maybe what I'm really saying is that the CV as a concept is not working for us now. It's not telling us what we need it to tell us. And if someone could invent a different format for people to explain what they would be bringing to a role, including their expertise and their industry expertise, those things that of course have value, but get away from the job titles, then I think that we would be onto something. And then being able to say, I was home raising my children and simultaneously I was raising 1.5 million for charity and simultaneously I was a worked for the National Trust as a volunteer. Great. And all those things have validity in themselves for a particular role that you might be going for.
I mean, the CV becomes the calling card, really. I mean, it's almost like a business card, isn't it? But just a longer one. I mean, it's interesting. I've just employed somebody and I hadn't realized until we were having this conversation that I literally haven't seen her CV. After I had met her once, I looked on LinkedIn because I thought, oh, I should probably know the jobs that she's done before so that I can brief the next people in the business she's going to be meeting. But there was no CV. And actually, in the first hour I spent with her, we didn't even talk about her job. We talked about conscious leadership and, you know, why she gets excited about it, why she's interested in it, what it means to her. It was very much a values-led conversation. And I know, I mean, because I spent my formative years in recruitment, I know that all of the sort of tests that have been done around validity in relation to, you know, if you just do an interview, it's sort of 0.3 on the validity scale. And if you do a psychometric as well, it goes up. And if you do, you know, some sort of assessment center, it goes up, et cetera, et cetera. There's something around FaceTime with an individual that helps you to really understand them and really get to know them. And there needs to be some sort of way that they come to you in the first place. And I think if you're lucky enough to have networks, you could probably get referrals or recommendations, and then CVs actually don't necessarily have the same role to play. But I think, well, you know, this is where just filming a little bit of like, this is me, this is who I am, this is what's important to me. These are the highlights of my life so far. And you can include career and, you know, general life as well. You know, little showreel. You've got a showreel because you're a speaker. Maybe we should all just have a little showreel as our, you know, scrap CVs, get a little showreel.
Well, I would love to hear from companies who are just either not prioritizing the CV or not. I'd really love to hear from organizations that are not asking for CV at all and what they're doing instead. And I'd also really love to hear from diversity and inclusion specialists about whether there is something inherently exclusive about a CV and whether it favors certain groups of people over other groups of people, whether it's anti-diversity. Please connect with us on LinkedIn. I'll put the links to both of our profiles on the show notes for today. And we will be back next week.
Fantastic. Lovely to spend quality time with you, Blair.
Yeah, and lovely to spend time with you and with our lovely listener.
Bye.